kneel before Zol!
Everything is fine on the other side of the blue sky. Push off the wall, push off the wall, push off the wall, push off the wall. And everything is fine on the other side of the blue sky.
Push. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to the Best Movie Ever podcast. My name is Sean, and with me, as always, is my wonderful co-host, Mr. Aiden Redman.
Thanks, man. How's it going, everybody? How's it going, Sean?
It's going pretty well. I think it's going pretty well for you. You're apparently knocking back a little whiskey right now.
Hell yeah. So. I read this thing on BuzzFeed this past week that was just like the 22 great reasons to drink whiskey. And, like, I only needed one great reason to drink whiskey to begin with.
Podcasting? What were the reasons?
Yeah, exactly. But there are all these, like, health benefit reasons that are, like, It's better for you for wine. It's, like, it'll help you. You won't get dementia later on in life. You won't have strokes. I'm like, holy shit, I need to start drinking whiskey all the time.
Well, right? I'll be sure to do it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah, exactly. So this is, like, the new red wine for me. Yeah. It's pretty great. Anyway, but it kind of pales in comparison to what you're drinking right now, Sean.
Just cheap Trader Joe's beer, which is horrible.
It's good, horrible.
I guess, if you're looking for the cheap route, as I am always.
It's funny. There are, like, so few beers out there that I really, like, have been seeking out, like, anxiously in simpler times is, like, at the top of the list for some reason.
I mean, I think you're going to be kind of underwhelmed.
I'm going to be blown away. I can't wait.
But anyway, for the uninitiated... This isn't a podcast about beer or alcohol. It's a podcast about two completely nerdy gentlemen such as ourselves, who get together and talk about movies and the cinema going experience. We usually split each episode up into three segments. The first segment is always what we've been watching lately. The second segment this week, instead of our movie question of the week, is going to be a Man of Steel showdown between Aiden and I, because we spoke about like the DC Comics versus Marvel Comics last episode, which was before Man of Steel came out, and it has since come out and I think done pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, it only was number one at the box office the first weekend it was out. Then it got knocked out by whatever it came out.
Monsters University.
Monsters University, World War Z.
So we've had a chance to see it, and we will talk about our completely different opinions about the movie.
It's going to get real, yo.
And then for segment three, in honor of Lone Ranger, the new Gore Verbinski, Jerry Bruckheimer, massive Pirates of the Caribbean kind of thing with Johnny Depp and Armie Hammer.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out, July 4th?
Yeah, man.
Pretty patriotic.
Can't wait.
So in honor of that, we're doing Best Western ever.
Hell yeah.
In our humble opinions. And I think our opinions are quite humble on the Western genre, wouldn't you say?
Oh, you gotta be humble, man.
Exactly. So, why don't we just go into what we've been watching?
I'm all for it, man. Yeah, I'll go. Sure. I was hoping to be able to talk about Before Midnight, but I haven't seen it yet. But I just watched
it's so good.
Before Sunrise and Before Sunset for the first time this past week, and that was, like, unbelievable.
Really?
It was so good. I'm like, I can't wait to see where Jesse and Celine are next. Like, oh, it's so good. Anyway, gotta hold that off till the next podcast, because I really just want to see how it
goes. Let me just ask you right quick. Which one out of the first two do you like better?
It's really hard. Yeah. To say. Probably the second one, I was I was smiling more and just so happy to be with them again, and, like, it's so funny the way, I'm just gonna save it for the next week, but yeah, I like the second one more, but that's, like, splitting hairs, to be honest. They're so good.
I'll have to say this, the ending of the second one is probably one of my favorite endings of all
time. It's great. You're gonna miss that plane. I know. Ooh. That was awesome.
Anyway, we'll talk about it once you've seen Before Midnight, which is absolutely spectacular.
I know, that's what I'm already waiting to love that movie. So but other than that, I saw This Is the End, and This Is the End, you were right, was totally the funniest movie of the year so far, man.
Nice.
Like, I haven't seen a funny movie like that in years, you're right.
Yeah. I mean, It's so weird because it seems so, like, such a gimmicky plot.
Yeah.
But I think they find really interesting ways to sort of circumvent any cheesiness or like ways in which it could be misconstrued as, like, taking advantage of the audience based on their like celebrity.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah. I know what you mean.
But I mean, but yeah, I mean, what did you? What are some other observations?
I mean, it's just the gimmick like totally works. Like when I heard the idea of just like way back of them all playing themselves, I thought that was like a good idea because like you remember when in like Knocked Up, like the best part of that whole movie was them making fun of Martin Starr's beard like as themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like that was great. Like I could have done 2 hours of beard jokes. And, like that's kind of like what this premise is: is them like ragging on each other in the apocalypse. And,
yeah, and I think
it's like there hasn't been like a comedy since I was thinking about it, like Cedar Rapids was the last time I walked out of a movie and was just like giggling like an idiot to myself, thinking of like every single scene that was so funny. And it's like, yeah, I don't know. What were you going
to
say?
Well, I was going to say, to speak to your point about, you know, them ragging on Martin Starr's beard, like, it brings to mind the fact that in those other movies, the sort of Judd Apatow movies, when they're all together, they basically kind of, you know, meld into versions of themselves.
Yeah.
And so it's really, like, organic. And I think that they kind of erred on the side of making it work with this movie, you know, because I think any other group of sort of comedic actors or something like that, it could be, like I said, taking advantage of the audience and just being this, like too much of an inside joke. But
no, yeah, I get it. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's easy to be on the inside jokes because, like, they're just ragging on each other about, like, movies they've made and stuff.
Yeah,
about,
yeah.
Like, remember when you did this last Saturday or whatever? Like, it was so good, man. Like, everyone was so funny in that. And it was funny from beginning to end. Like, the ending was one of the best endings in, like, a comedy in forever.
Yeah.
It apparently
has the biggest penis in any movie ever.
I heard that too. That's quite the honor, I gotta say.
Yeah, yeah.
It was great, and like Audrey laughed her ass off too.
Really?
And,
cool.
Yeah. Oh, I had something else, but yeah, like you were saying, like them playing, they all do play kind of like not characters of themselves, but like just kind of like versions of themselves.
Yeah.
But I love the way they kind of wrote some of their friends like into it as just like, you know, Michael Cera was great. And just, like, even Danny McBride, who, like, is essentially just doing the whole, what is it?
What's oh,
like,
yeah.
Down and down.
Yeah, yeah.
Guy, yeah. So, like, but that alone is just, like, I'd watch 2 hours of that anyway. Like, oh.
Let me just ask you, did you get any, because the discussion last episode was about how, you know, it reminded me a lot of high concept comedies, like Ghostbusters or something like that?
Yeah.
Or sort of just John Landis movies.
Yeah.
You know, movies that have all this other technical prowess. I mean, the effects in this movie aren't really well, but I think some of the creature designs and everything are really interesting.
They were.
Like, did you
surprised.
Get that kind of like vibe of you know, those '80s movies that are, you know, multifaceted?
Yeah, high I got it. Comedies? I mean, I didn't know what direction it was going to go in with the whole apocalypse thing, and I thought it was like really kind of creative how they weaved in their own like careers and like into the whole salvation, I guess, not to spoil anything. But
it is a really honest storyline as well.
You know,
like the Jay Baruchel character is the one who doesn't really like all of the whole, like Hollywood glitz and stuff like that, and he is brought to LA and he has to go to James Franco's party with Seth Rogen.
Yeah.
And stuff like that, but
yeah, it's like, look, listen to me now, like I'm just giggling about like this thing, like just thinking about Jonah Hill when he's like playing with the gun and like like pointing at everybody, like,
and the like Rosemary's Baby Exorcist scene as well.
It was like, I don't know, I could go on. It's just one of those rare comedies. I'm like, remember this, quote this.
I'm also pretty hesitant to divulge a lot of the cameos. I know, I mean, we said Michael Cera, but there are other ridiculous, like, in a really hilarious way,
oh my God,
cameos in this movie, especially one at the very end.
One at the very end was totally... Well, there's one at, like, the very, very end, and there's one, like, 10 minutes before the end. And the one 10 minutes before the end is just, like, like totally insane.
Yeah, yeah.
That was great. I mean, I was totally... I don't know. I was... Like, I wanted to see it, but it's always nice to be, like, totally surprised that...
Yeah,
it is laugh,
good,
like crazy for a while. It was really good, I gotta say.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those ones to, like, when it comes out, to sort of get it and get some beer or some alcohol and, like, hang out with friends and just laugh a lot.
And it's funny, like, when I wrote my review the last week, like, people really, I seem like, gravitated towards that. Like, oh, shit, I got to see that now. Like, oh, yeah. This sounds awesome. I was hoping this was funny, more so than, like, Man of Steel, when everyone was just kind of like, oh, yeah, that was, like, everyone had already seen it instead of This Is the End. And so I was like, all right.
What number did you get it?
That was an 8, but it's, like, a high 8. It's, if I saw that again, if I had been bombed, it would have been a 9, I'm thinking. But, and with friends, you know, it would have been great.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's also, like you're saying, conducive of, like, the audience you see it with.
Yeah.
If you're in a theater, you know, the best way to see it is on, like, a Friday night packed or something like that. And it might be a bit too late for that, because I don't know how it's... I mean, I think it's done fairly well, but...
Yeah, I think it has done fairly well, especially considering what it was going up against.
Yeah. But, yeah, I'm glad you liked it.
Damn. Yeah, good recommendation. This is good. We have some good common ground to start off with this podcast.
But, until segment 2.
Yeah, it was. I was pleasantly surprised, I guess. Cool. But anyway, what you been watching, man?
I'll mention this movie very quickly. It's a horror movie called You're Next.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of home invasion movie, directed by this guy Adam Wingard, who is involved with the VHS movies.
Oh, okay. Do you know the first one or the second one?
Both of them, actually.
Which one? Do you know what segment you did in the first one?
I don't remember. I'm not sure.
All right.
I'm unprepared. I apologize. But he's a part of that kind of new horror wave of directors.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them, you know, I don't know, it's like mumblecore horror, I guess, which is pretty derogatory, which I hate. But anyway, it's like a twist on the home invasion movie.
Mm-hmm.
Amy Simetz is in it. She was in Upstream Color.
Okay.
Ty West, the dude who did
I love Ty West.
The Innkeepers and the House of the Devil is actually in it as well.
Oh, cool.
But it's really good. It's been on the shelf apparently from Lionsgate for a couple years. It like premiered at South by Southwest in 2011 or 10 or something like that. And
that's
weird. Yeah, I don't know. I think they've just held it. They don't really know what to do with it, and they're finally letting it out.
That's funny. Now that it's like a lot of like, good buzz about it.
Yeah, like, I mean, a lot of the buzz is on the internet and the South by Southwest crowd and the people who are really digging the VHS movies, which mm-hmm. I really liked. And I'll say it's a really, I mean, if you love horror movies like this, and or if you love horror movies in general, it's a great movie.
Nice.
Some of the logistics behind it, I was telling you before, are pretty ridiculously mm-hmm. convenient, and you know, if you're kind of I don't know, bothered by that kind of stuff, which I generally am,
yeah.
I guess, which we'll talk about in the Man of Steel thing, but I don't know, certain logistics in horror movies, you know, don't really hold as much weight in other movies, and these were kind of really blatant. And, but I mean, it didn't really take away from how much I like the movie. So
that's good. I'm happy.
So
I think
that comes out in August. And the other movie I've seen, I saw recently, and you can read my review on latinareview.com.
I know.
is Roland Emmerich's new movie, White House Down.
Yeah,
with Channing Tatum and Jamie Foxx.
So this looks like the stupidest movie, man. Like, but the thing is, it's getting pretty decent reviews.
Okay.
Looks like right now.
Yes. So I mean, Roland Emmerich, however you pronounce his name, is like a. I don't know. I was gonna say he's a nothing director to me. I just think I'm just kind of apathetic to him. I mean, I enjoy. You know, who doesn't enjoy Independence Day? The Patriot is one of those movies I saw when I was like younger. Yeah, he did The Patriot. You know, that's like a pretty ridiculous
totally
historical
ridiculous, actually.
Movie.
Yeah.
And so that was the sort of mindset that I went in. I mean, this is obviously a ridiculous director. And, you know, he likes to blow things up. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you go into it with that mindset, I think you'll like it. I mean, it's the best Die Hard movie in a really long time.
Well,
you know,
that's a good comparison.
Yeah, I mean, it totally apes the whole framework of Die Hard, where you know a lot of people are taken hostage in this one, you know, place, and they have to be saved by this one guy. In this case, that guy is Channing Tatum, and he's also trying to protect the president.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me,
played by Jamie Foxx.
Yeah, right? Which is kind of ridiculous, right? But, I mean, he's able to... I mean, again, it's a Roland Emmerich movie. It's not supposed to be serious, but they implant a lot of these, like, serious moments for Jamie Foxx in the beginning, kind of making him out to be this, like, young president. You know, the corollaries between Obama are kind of, you know, simple, you know, but they're there.
Okay.
But, I mean, it's a lot of fun, and the thing that I took away with it, took away from it, is that Roland Emmerich is finally sort of self-aware. He's self-aware of his complete ridiculousness, and so he ups the humor. He makes mm-hmm. the humor and the action, you know, at the same level.
Yeah,
and
that's a good thing.
Yeah, and I think before, I mean, a lot of the movies were pretty self-serious with
you're right.
these, like, you know, comedic moments peppered in to just try to relieve the plot of all the seriousness. But here, I mean, the rapport between Jamie Foxx and Channing Tatum is completely hilarious amidst this, like, ridiculous, like, terrorist plot. You know,
I mean, it looks ridiculous. I'm glad he appreciates that.
It is. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I really enjoyed the fact that he's, like, embraced how ridiculous it is. I mean, some of the lines in this movie are like, absurd. You know, it wanders into the realm of those, like, so bad it's good movies.
That's good. If it's going to be a bad movie, I'd rather it be that kind.
But the thing is that it's not a bad movie. You know, like, The Happening or something like that is such a bad movie that it's that you, like, want to get drunk and watch it. This one is, like, a pretty cheesy movie that's really good in terms of, you know, what it promises you, the action and the comedy and, you know, the overall Roland Emmerich, you know, directorial calling cards of just, like, a lot of explosions and, you know, American landmarks that are in jeopardy. It's pretty, I mean, I don't know, I'd hesitate to say go see it in theaters just because, you know, it's not too pressing. I would definitely watch it when it comes out just as, like, a fun kind of thing.
So see that, or see Before Midnight, one of the other.
I mean, in theaters? I don't know. I mean,
they're, like, pretty similar, I heard, so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in Before Midnight, both Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, like, ride a limo around the White House lawn while being shot at by a Gatling gun, and it just so happens...
It's profound. That
it happens in White House Down, too. It's crazy.
I mean, I totally saw them growing old together like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I mean, it's up to your discretion. I thought it was... complete and utter, like, absurd fun, you know, and
that's good. I'm glad it's not taking itself super seriously, because, like, the trailers make it, like, it's like, okay, like, it's still we're in, like, a post 9/11 world. It's still kind of like, and there goes the White House, there goes the National Monument, but I mean, still, it's like, if it's with the right tone, whatever.
I mean, yeah, the tone is pretty spot on, you know, as, like, this kind of afternoon action movie.
Yeah,
you know, the you know, we're talking I was talking about logistics before, and the logistics of the sort of terrorist plot and how they get into the White House is pretty absurd. It's, I can say it without spoiling much, but they pose as technicians who are installing a new sound system in the White House theater, and somehow they just get access to every room of the White House because they're just technicians.
They're technicians, though, man.
You know, they've got to. So, but anyway.
Wow. All right. Well, hey, whatever.
Yeah.
Thank God Channing Tatum was on the president's side.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like I said, it's the best Die Hard movie, you know, in years. Nice. And I think it wears its influences on its shoulder. I mean, Channing Tatum wears, like, a wife beater and everything.
Hell yeah. That's his favorite outfit, man.
And, you know, Channing Tatum's like I think he's like a bona fide star. I don't know.
I'm liking it more and more, man. He had a really good year last year.
The dude can do a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you know, he's so versatile and, you know, I like it.
Yeah. Oh, that's, I think, you know what? Yeah. Channing Tatum's had a good year this year, too.
Yeah.
But, I mean, how does it rank against, like, Independence Day? One of the greatest movies ever made.
I mean, Independence Day is, like, this large scale kind of thing. And, you know, a global perspective. This is just, like, pretty focused on this one guy.
Yeah.
In this like, contained location. I mean, you can't really compare it, but I heard Roland Emmerich's doing Independence Day 2 as his next movie. So you got that to look forward to.
I mean, there was so much left unsaid with Independence Day. Exactly. Oh, my God. that guy. Yeah. Well, all right. Well, I mean, I will see it. I'm, like, totally surprised by the reviews. And since I still have to see the new Die Hard 2, it's probably going to be good to
see. Don't see it.
I, like, do not see it just for the sake of, like...
It is terrible. It's really bad.
I'm just going to have it on the background.
It's look, horrible. I mean, you can just watch White House Down and pretend that Channing Tatum's Bruce Willis or something like that, and it would be so much better than just sitting through that shitty, like, a Good Day to Die Hard movie.
I know. I probably shouldn't, but I will. Don't do it. I'm sorry.
Watch the original one, at least.
Of course. Don't worry. I've seen them all. But hey, I'm glad to hear it's good, and I'm glad to hear your next is pretty good. I'm actually pretty jazzed about that.
Yeah.
All right. So. Well, groovy. So shall we get down to it, man?
Let's get to arguing.
All right. So I'm trying to think. All right. Let's, for setting it up sake, segment two, everybody, is about Man of Steel. We both saw it. I loved it. Sean, not so much.
No.
So I was trying to think of how we should address this, how we should start the showdown. And it seems like your real issue is with the last 45 minutes, understandably.
I mean, yes. Specifically the last 45 minutes. But, I mean, there are other things in the movie altogether that really bug me as well that I think are big problems.
Okay, should we... So, with that said, I'm going to say we start with before the last 45 minutes.
Sure.
And then work our way up to, like...
Yeah, the wanton and unbelievable destruction in the last 45 minutes.
Exactly. Okay, so... Sean, you go first. What's one thing you weren't crazy about Man of Steel before the 45 minutes?
All right, we're doing spoilers here, so I'm just going to talk about
everything. Yeah, everybody, this is spoiler alert stuff.
Okay, so I will say before I jump into how this movie is completely terrible, that I liked certain things about it. I think the casting was really good. I think Henry Cavill makes for, like, a great-looking Superman, and he, you know, tried his hardest to be that kind of, you know, hero. Obviously, Michael Shannon is pretty amazing as Zod.
He yells a lot in this movie.
He yells quite a lot, but, you know, he's a pretty menacing dude to begin with, and he brings a sort of, you know, weight to that, you know, villain, I think.
Yeah.
And I think I even have a little soft spot in my heart for Russell Crowe as Jor-El.
I thought he was better in this than I've seen him in a long time, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, he was good, but you know, if we're gonna jump right in to what I didn't like, I think
that's it. That's all you liked about it?
Well, no. I mean, I think I liked.
No. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, another thing that I like is the way that it tried for realism. It tried to bring it out of, I don't know, because I hesitate to say it was brought out of the mythology. I think it tried to tell a more real story than any of the Superman, specifically, like Superman Returns and,
right. and a lot of that. It's less a comic book, it's less like Richard Donner stuff.
Yeah. And it, you know, and it went the sort of Nolan route in that way.
Yeah.
Okay, so one of the things that I really, really disliked, I think we can... I don't know, because there is so much that I disliked. But, okay, so I think one of the things that bugged me most was that it tried to be a sci-fi movie instead of being a superhero movie.
Like how it started out on Krypton?
Yeah, I mean, it tries to be this, like... I think the way it went about Krypton was it tried to make it matter. But I think the general weight behind that was the fact that they... get Superman, you know, Kal-El off of the planet. Mm-hmm. And I realize that is the, you know, you have to get to know Jor-El and you have to get to know, why he thinks, you know, what he thinks and why he says what he says.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just, you know, pretty ridiculous spectacle that could have been glossed over in the, like, voiceover that he does on the ship. Mm-hmm. Later.
Okay, that's a good point.
And I will say that also, the character of Jor-El basically, you know, all of his dialogue is just platitudes. It's just you know, trying to be bumper stickers. You know what I mean?
Yes,
you know,
that is a lot of the dialogue in this movie.
It's trying to be, you know, a statement that they can throw in the trailer or they can throw on the poster or something like that. It's just not dialogue. It's not, you know, people talking to other people. It's just, you know, every time Russell Crowe shows up, he's just saying these, you know, completely, you know, faux profound things. And
he's
some,
like,
you know,
he's like the leading scientist on Krypton, dude. Don't you get it?
I guess. But I mean, doesn't the leading scientist of Krypton, can he, you know, talk normally for once? I mean, I think that doesn't really get to my main point. I think I get the early parts in Krypton. I think my main problem with those kind of things, the sort of platitudes and the declarative dialogue of Jor-El, happen in a lot in the flashbacks, which I found to be a big problem. You know, that they have these flashbacks that just interrupt, completely take the narrative to a grinding halt.
Like with on Krypton or with John?
Well, yeah, I think I'm kind of like pushing the father figures together.
Okay.
But anyway, I mean, yeah, I mean, can you respond to any of the like mumbling?
Yes. No, I got it.
I definitely want to talk about the structure of it as well.
Okay.
But go ahead.
I get what you're saying with the sci-fi thing. I didn't feel like it was a sci-fi thing, but like from an outside perspective, third body experience, outside whatever it is, I can get it. It's very, when I saw it, I was like, okay, this is not what I expected Krypton to look like. I wasn't expecting it to take place so heavily in Krypton for the first, what was it, like 15 minutes or so?
Yeah, 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah. But it was cool in the sense, like, I don't know. Hold on, before I get to that, I'll agree with you with the dialogue. The dialogue wasn't great in this movie. The dialogue was pretty forced pretty much throughout. Yeah. Even with Michael Shannon, who could make absolute garbage like look like gold. But, I mean, I feel like the reason I liked so much of this movie and could forgive a lot of it kind of plays into a lot of my arguments later on is that I watched Superman 2, the original one, for the first time before this. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen that before?
Not in a really long time.
All right. So, back when we were kids, it was probably awesome. Now, it's not so awesome. I mean, it's very kind of like canned characters, canned villains that don't really have any, like, I don't know, Zod just like, I don't know. He's just like a one-note guy who just kind of gets...
You're talking in Superman 2.
Superman 2, who gets forbidden, who gets sent to the Forbidden Zone. The Phantom Zone. Phantom Zone, come on. Because he just wants to lead. He wants to, like, rule over people.
Yeah.
That's just his thing. And, like, his other two cronies are just, like, I don't know, Nick and Knack. They're dumbasses who just, like, are following him like lapdogs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that was it. That's, like, he just comes to Earth and he's like, I will rule over Earth at the end. And that's his whole thing. And here I was like, all right, like, they're added another layer to it. Like, he was born to rule, and like he wants to start a new civilization for Krypton, and that's just like born into his DNA. Like, that's what he's Zod, the new Zod. Yeah, and so I feel like the whole intro, looking back on it, as much as I appreciated how like surprisingly good Russell Crowe was as Jor-El, not that it like, I don't know, made the movie for me, but I thought it was a good setup for Zod, and kind of like being like, okay, like we all know Zod, we generally like Zod, the old Zod, but here's like the new Zod, who's really like, he's a fucking man on a mission, dude. Like, this guy's gonna save his people no matter what, like, no matter the cost. And so, like, once he shows up again, it's kind of like there's more depth to his character, I suppose.
And we should talk about the MacGuffin of this movie, which is completely, you know, I mean, it's sort of explained, but it makes absolutely no sense. The codex.
Yeah, the codex. That's right.
Like, why is it a skull?
Yeah, that confused the hell out of my dad.
How does it represent every Kryptonian? I don't know.
It's like, it's... I mean, they added that thing
where every Kryptonian is made for a specific job.
Right.
And they're all, like, harvested, like the Matrix or something.
Yeah.
And
that's right. It's totally
that, Kal-El is the first natural birth on Krypton in generations.
Right. Which was, okay, like, so heresy, according to Zod.
So he's special, yes.
Yeah.
So. But, I mean... I guess that is my biggest... Oh, my other... I guess I'm going to be nitpicky. Allow me to be nitpicky. If Krypton was just going to implode and they needed to get everyone off of...
I totally know what you're saying, and you're totally right.
Off of the planet. Why didn't they just go to the fucking Phantom Zone where they sent Zod and all of his cronies, which is like, basically you need to go through a little portal and you end up in the Phantom Zone. At least they'll be alive somewhere.
I didn't think of that. I was just more like, why did you even bother sending him to the Phantom Zone? Why didn't you just let him blow up with the rest of you guys?
That's true. I mean, yes. That is a convenient plot point.
Yeah, I know.
But I was going to say, like, if everyone else on Krypton needed to get away, just go to the Phantom Zone, I guess. I mean, they have the world engines...
Yes, to, that, you know, that was to a terrible name. Terrible name for like a device like that. World Engine, seriously.
I think that was the you know, they're trying to be pulpy or something like that. Which it brought up one of the greatest, at least the best lines from this movie, which is like, "Unleash the World Engine."
Yeah.
But
like
Liam
Neeson,
yeah. I mean, that was the I don't know. At least for Krypton, those are my things. I think we should talk about the structure of the movie.
All
right. Which is problematic, I think, to me.
Okay, go ahead.
Because I think when we talk about, like, a nonlinear storyline, or at least this one, which relies heavily on flashbacks, something like the Batman, or Batman Begins, which had a pretty nonlinear storyline, which Nolan has a complete kind of grasp on.
Yeah, but...
It imbued it with enough story... and pace enough to sort of wrap around and then slingshot back to where you were, at least. whereas this, it sort of keeps going, and then it goes back to Jonathan Kent, which I like Kevin Costner. He was pretty good as Jonathan Kent. But again, he all of the father figures in this movie just say, like pretty cheesily profound things.
Yeah, they do. I'll give you that. When he shows, when he shows little Clark the spaceship for the first time, I was like, "Oh boy."
Yeah,
but
I think when it goes back to those times, it just like it stalls the movie. I think, and I really don't know how it could have been remedied in terms of trying to tell the background of Superman. I mean, at least, or in my mind, the flashbacks themselves are so blatant in what they're trying to do, like tell the audience how much of a struggle Superman is having, yet how special he is supposed to be, and stuff like that. And it was just like, every time it would go back to Smallville in the past, it would just be like, you know, the thesis statement of those scenes would be, you're special, and you need to realize it. And soon, like, humanity will realize it too.
Yeah.
And it was just like, there was nothing else to those scenes besides that. I mean, they tried it at different angles, like, you know, him finding the spaceship or him saving a group of kids in a school bus or something like that. And it was just like, or him getting bullied. It was just like, some of those could have been taken out, I think.
Right.
You know, because it was just hitting the audience on the head. And if they couldn't, you know, deduce the fact that Superman is super, you know, plainly from at least these flashbacks, then it was like, you know, what were they for?
Right. All right, so in defense of those flashbacks, I totally get where you're coming from. It's not exactly subtle, I agree, but...
Nothing about this movie is subtle.
That's true. Okay, so, but the thing that I really liked about it was that my whole thing with Superman, especially Superman growing up, is if I had superpowers like that, and if my son had superpowers like that, before going into this movie, I was like, why the hell would you hide that from everybody? Why wouldn't you be like, you know what? You got something special going on, kid. Like, you're a freaking alien, and you're, like, super... You are superhuman. You could save the world. You could change everything. Like, I don't understand why, before going in, I was like, I don't understand why Jonathan Kent would have been, like, wouldn't have had an outlook anything beside that. And so, for me, the reason the flashbacks work, I really like the last flashback in the movie, too. You know, with the little cape and stuff. I was like, yeah, I dig that.
Oh, God.
Oh, I like that. But, sorry, man. And,
oh, God.
But still, I was like, okay. With him talking about how, like, it would upset, like, how it would affect humanity's, like, view of, like, the world and, like, the universe as a whole to know that he existed on Earth and, like, was so different and how that would affect everything and how it would change him, not only the world, but him. And I was like, okay, I'm starting to come over to his side. I'm not saying I would do that if I was Superman's dad, but seeing him and, like, understanding his motivation for it, like, I totally get it. I bought into it. It was cool.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I feel like that was, that kind of built up into the whole, you know, why Superman is Superman. Like, why we all, not we all, but at least I, why I'm so nuts about Superman. In the sense of, like, he's just this personification of everything that's so good and, like, what about us? Look at you laughing at me. Shut up, Sean.
No, I'm not. I'm just laughing because this movie doesn't do that. I mean, what happens in this movie, like, doesn't uphold the things that it's saying. Like, I don't want to interrupt you, but
Is that the last 45 minutes you're talking about?
Well, that is a blatant example, but I was going to say, at least in the flashbacks,
okay,
you know, Jonathan Kent's always like, you can't, you know, humanity doesn't know. Humanity can't know. But, like, you know, you have to wait. But why? I mean, you know, the scene where he dies in, like, a tornado, why would he not reveal himself there? I mean, is it really that much of a problem? You know, he says, like, you have to wait, you know, for humanity to be ready. Mm-hmm. And I guess that it takes for, you know, this absolute complete destruction for him to reveal himself, but he doesn't really willingly reveal himself. There's this ultimatum thrown at him, and he just kind of reluctantly goes out and says, like, yep, I'm the alien here. So all of the things that are promised, all of the sort of triumphant things that Jonathan Kent is trying to say to him are completely false.
He believes so strongly. He believed more strongly.
Jonathan Kent does?
He believes more strongly that his son needs to, like, keep his powers hidden, yet, like, be a good person without doing that he, like, would rather die in a tornado than have his son reveal himself to all these people under the bridge.
That's ridiculous, though. That's absolutely ridiculous. If he's trying to say, like, you can show humanity all the powers that you can do to save them, why can't he just save the one person telling him all these things? I guess that's the dramatic angle, but it's like what he's saying goes against all of the things that come after that. You know what I mean?
I get it. I get what you're saying. That's kind of like the why wouldn't John Kent just tell his son to, like, save everybody kind of thing.
It's just so philosophically empty to me. Oh, you know, and
that's deep.
You know, cuz it is true that he's like, you are special. You are a god amongst men.
Yeah.
And you can't just, like, be pretty casual about this stuff. You need to wait until people are ready and you're ready. And at that moment where, at least the moment where his father is about to die, he's completely ready. And nothing happens. It only takes someone, like, this complete outside force to sort of blackmail him into coming out that he does.
Well, it's not really blackmail, man. He's, like, put into a corner, dude. He's like, I could either go with the start a new Krypton or let all of humanity get wiped out.
True.
So, I mean,
he
basically
listened
to his dad, didn't want him to go. He could have gone. But
yeah. He basically waits and lets a huge swath of one of the biggest cities on Earth get wiped out.
Okay.
But we'll talk about that later. But anyway, another nitpick was Lois Lane, who's completely wasted in this movie.
Yeah, she was kind of wasted in this movie. You're right. And, like, I didn't get how, like, their relationship progressed to the point that it did.
Ugh.
Like, I'm with you on that one.
We'll talk about their, like, romantic relationship in a bit.
Them
but
standing in the desert longingly.
But just plainly, like, how does she have all this, like, government access, and why is she in this Antarctic top secret army?
She's a Pulitzer-winning reporter, Sean.
But, I mean, why is she the only Pulitzer reporting or Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter there? And she does absolutely no journalism in this movie whatsoever. Once all of the sort of military stuff kicks in, she's just miraculously in, like, fatigues, hanging out on a gigantic plane with all the military people. Like, why is she there?
You know what? I will say this. Lois Lane has a history of getting into sticky situations like that. Forget the story. She does, man. Watch Superman 2 again. She gets stuck on the Eiffel Tower. It's crazy.
Amy Adams, fine actress?
I thought she was fine in the role. I thought that whole line about her, she was like, can we stop comparing each other's dick sizes right now? I was like, all right. She's got sassy. I dig it.
She's spunky. Yeah. Lois Lane is supposed to be spunky. But, I mean, the sort of motivation behind her character is just like, she's just caught up in it, and for some reason she gets brought up on the fucking spaceship with Zod, and she has to put that, like, oxygen thing on, and then Jor-El shows up out of nowhere and just showing her how to shoot people. And
well, that was the Codex, Sean. He was in the Codex.
Yeah. But Superman is the Codex, apparently.
Well, they're, like, one and the same. They have the
How can, like, a projection of Jor-El just show up on this alien evil ship?
Brother, you're talking about Kryptonian technology right now.
I guess.
This is beyond your understanding. Just let it be.
Yeah. I guess that you can do it with throwaway lines like that, but it was just like, bring her up to the ship and then get her off of the ship.
Yeah,
and then have Superman save her because she's a damsel in distress.
Yeah, I forget why she went up there.
I guess because she knew who Superman was, but then Superman just comes to her rescue anyway.
Yeah.
But,
I don't know. But anyway, yeah, she gets into those unfortunate spots throughout
situations.
The movie. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I mean, Amy Adams, I feel like she's, I don't know, a couple of people I've talked to have given her a bad rap, but I thought she was fine. I think she gets a bad rap generally for some reason.
She's a great actress in general.
She's good. Yeah,
here,
I think she kicked ass in the Fighter a couple of years ago. I don't know. Yeah, that totally got put on the back burner, though. But also in Superman 2, like, her and Superman's relationship is, like, front and center the whole time. It's, like, half the movie is them, like, in love, her finding out, like, that Clark Kent is actually Superman, and then him, like, it's so stupid.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, well, the romance here is completely unearned.
Oh, absolutely. It's totally unearned. Unearned. I feel like it's not... All right. If this was, like, if they're not going to make a sequel, it's pretty unfortunate.
Oh, they're making a sequel.
Yeah, they're making a sequel. So, hopefully, I'm thinking, like, they have another movie to kind of redeem themselves as far as Lois and Clark is concerned. Because that's, like, so integral to the whole Superman mythology, I suppose.
What they should have done is waited until the second one because at the end of this movie, spoilers again, Clark Kent gets a job at the Daily Planet, and that's where the romance should have started. He should have, like, saved her from complete and utter destruction as Superman.
Yeah.
And she should have been like, man, this guy's foxy. And then in the second one, they could have, started their romance. It was so forced into this movie that they just stand in this, like, field of complete destruction or this, like, cornfield or whatever and just, like, kiss or...
But, I mean, speaking of that scene at the Daily Planet, I thought that was fucking stupid. I was like...
At the end? At the very end?
Just because, like, I love the whole approach they took with Clark Kent in this movie in the sense that, like, he's not Clark Kent. He's not, like, the bumbling idiot at the Daily Planet. And that's, like, because he has glasses and he's a dumbass. He can fool everybody into thinking that he's not Superman.
Yeah. He doesn't wear glasses until the very end.
Yeah, not until the very end. But I was like, thank God they got rid of that. That was stupid all these years. Like, are we really that... Is everyone in Metropolis really that stupid?
And yes, they are, apparently.
Yeah,
they had to shoehorn it in.
Yeah, and so I was like, great, they got rid of that. Now he's, like, hitting the road, like Bruce Banner, just, like, going from place to place. And so when that came up at the end, I was like, fuck, man, like, don't do that. Like, just rewrite his story. Like, make him something else or give him a mustache, something. Like,
how does he shave?
Yeah. It's a fake mustache. I don't give a shit.
To be fair, I did like the sort of wandering Superman thing.
Yeah, I like that too. I was like, that's if he was brought up to be like, you gotta hide your shit, man.
Yeah.
Like, then that totally makes sense.
Yeah, the whole like, you know, because that is essentially Superman. You know, he waits until something is completely out of humanity's hands, and you know, he saves these innocent people from this like oil rig disaster.
Yeah.
You know, that was Superman, and I was like, oh, I'm so on board with this. But then, you know, like I said, once it goes into the completely forced backstory stuff and tries to shove it down your throat, that's when it was just like, this is not how it should be told.
I get it.
But I
gotta say, though, the whole explanation of the S on his costume, I thought that was great.
Yeah, I like
that. I was
that.
Like, the whole movie, I was like, okay, if it's a Kryptonian costume... Like, why? And they don't call him Superman. What the fuck is with that costume?
They do call him Superman once.
Oh, they do, but not the Kryptonians.
No.
Like, I was like, what's going on with this? And so when they finally said it, I was like, oh, okay. That's a pretty good, like, original explanation for it.
It means hope. Aww.
But that's like, I get it. I don't know. I was expecting them not to address it at all. Yeah. And just us being like, it means Superman, but whatever. It worked.
But that also speaks to, like, why is this movie called Man of Steel? There's no reason for
the reason it's called Man of Steel, I'm guessing, is because, like, The Dark Knight did so well.
Exactly, but The Dark Knight meant something.
No, that's like, true. That's true.
The Man of Steel, there's no reference to any Man of Steel or anything like that in this movie. It makes no sense for it to be called Man of Steel. The Dark Knight, like, is referenced by the characters for a particular reason in those movies, and it's warranted. The title of Man of Steel, it's complete nonsense if you're talking about this particular movie.
Yeah.
It should have been called Superman because of the nickname that they give it.
That's true.
I understand what they were going for.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there was a reason for Nolan calling it The Dark Knight. There's not a reason for any of them to call this movie the Man of Steel.
That's a very good point. That is a very good point. I got nothing else to say on that. It's a very good point.
So, shall we talk about the last 45
minutes? Okay, let's talk about the last 45 minutes. All right. I don't know if you're going to jive with my justification of the last 45 minutes. I'm not saying it's totally justified either. So.
Explain to the people what happens to Metropolis in the last 45 minutes of this movie.
It gets, like, completely razed, folks. It's just, like...
By the world engines.
Yeah, by the world engines.
Which apparently there's two of them, somehow. Well, how are there two?
Well, they found the outpost.
He says, we found a world engine, and now apparently there's two.
Well, like, their ship was one world engine, and then they was, one part of the world engine, and they picked... You know what? It was there, Sean. You missed it, okay?
I guess I missed it. Anyway, explain, please. I'm sorry.
All right. When the first 45 minutes started going down, like, when they're in, I don't know, it was Smallville or some other, like, Midwest town, and he's fighting the... Zod's two cronies.
Yeah.
And shit gets, like, real. And, like, shit starts blowing up. And it turns into, like, Tekken, the movie. Just, like...
Such a video game.
It's totally a video game. It totally is. But my justification is, like, alright, we're dealing with Kryptonians here. We're dealing with, like, superpower Kryptonians. These are aliens. Like, we clearly cannot even fathom, like, how strong these people are. Like, what they're capable of doing. And if they're, like, trained military Kryptonians, like these two guys, against Superman, who's already can hold his own no problem, like, okay, I get it. Like, it's gonna, like, shit's gonna go down big time. And, like, you know, it's totally, the tone shifts, like, crazy from that point forward, as far as just going from, like, a character-driven, you know, kind of meditation of sorts. Not meditation. That's giving it too much credit on Superman. Yeah. But to something that just like, all right, Superman's going to save the world now. But I think that, I mean, that was one part of it, and then it gets serious. That's when the world engine starts, and then once he starts fighting Zod, and the buildings just start collapsing, and just, like, casualties, casualties, casualties that we don't see but are probably in those buildings. And I mean, my, like, I, the thing is, the thing that I justified it as is, it's, again, two Kryptonians fighting, like, shit's gonna go down big time, farther, more so than we can imagine. And the reason I think Superman could justify that kind of destruction is that if he, if it led to something like that, if he had to kill Zod, if the other alternative was in all of humanity going down, then like the buildings could go, the people could go. It's just like the need. Of the great, what is it? What's that line from Star Trek? The need of the many
outweighs the few.
Outweighs the need of the few. And so, so that's what I was thinking. I was like, this isn't very Superman behavior, but someone on my blog.
it's not Superman behavior whatsoever.
It's not, but well, I'll get to that. Someone on my blog said that apparently Superman in the new, like, 52, which is like the new reboot of all DC's comics and stuff, like, he throws people into buildings and buildings come down all the freaking time. So there's that kind of like, okay, this isn't that out of the ordinary, but when I was watching it, I'll totally agree. I was like, okay, Superman, you gotta like get your shit
tone it down.
Like, you gotta stop throwing Zod into like one building after another. Like, you're gonna kill the editor at the Daily Planet any second now.
Yes.
I get that. And all right. I'm feeling like a lot of people, probably including yourself, I'm guessing, wasn't as forgiving as I was.
Yeah. All right, let me comment on all of that.
Okay.
So, on top of the battle in Smallville being the most ridiculous product placement I've seen in a while, you know, with Sears and multiple mentions of IHOP for no fucking reason.
Oh, yeah, IHOP gets
and
trash.
Just
that's
conveniently
right.
Place Sears, IHOP, and 7-Eleven logos just right in the middle of the fucking screen, all in, like, within blocks of each other in this small town in Kansas is ridiculous.
Well, there was a LexCorp.
Yeah, which is what the logo should have been. Not true, fucking not, you know,
Lexhop.
Superman gets a fucking Slurpee in the middle of fighting everyone.
That's true.
But anyway, okay. I understand that the battles between them are Kryptonian, like they are gods on Earth.
Exactly, yeah.
It needs to be that way. But I feel like the way to portray that, they could have shown it in a different way that didn't really take you out of the movies themselves. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so extreme.
Right.
That it completely kind of takes you out of the reality that it's set up, the realism that it's made Superman, you know, the story to be up until then.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he turns into this, you know, God character, but I think it's, like I said, to the extreme.
Right.
You know, all of this punching and stuff, there's no repercussions. They just get thrown through, like, silos and IHOPs and all this stuff, and they just get back up again.
So many IHOPs.
Yeah. They just get back up again.
Yeah.
There could have been some sort of ramifications to that, and which I'll talk about later. You know, I think they took the extreme and it should have been weighed a little bit differently, at least with that battle in Smallville. Because I do think that the female villain, Feora or whatever her name is a really, really sinister and good villain.
Right.
Like, sidekick to Zod.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just throwing people everywhere, it just was like, okay, I guess, it looks cool, I guess, but it just takes you out.
I feel like that's a lot of Zack Snyder coming into play.
Yeah.
Just like over the top.
Okay. Yeah. So then basically the plan of Zod is to take these world engines, which are positioned at opposite ends of the globe.
Yep.
One in Smallville, or one in Metropolis, one in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, mind you, with absolutely no one around. And they basically terraform the Earth into a new Krypton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it should be said, like, why are they even trying to terraform Earth into Krypton if they're gods on Earth anyway? You know,
yeah,
that's a logistical thing.
Like, here's the thing, though. It seems like they wouldn't be able to survive if it wasn't their own.
But the sun, gives them. But our sun gives them superpowers.
That's true, but that's like just part of it, man. They need Kryptonian food and shit. I don't know. Agriculture.
Anyway, so the thing is that they turn on these world engines and they create these like massive pulses that like flatten the areas gradually.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, Superman flies to the opposite side of the world, to the Indian Ocean, where mm-hmm. there's no one around, mm-hmm. and he has his big moment where he realizes that he can be Superman, and he, you know, destroys this world engine.
That didn't get you all inspired or anything?
Well, hold on.
Okay.
And then he lets the army fly, like, some fucking missile or something like that, like mm-hmm. something, you know, some techno babble about how his ship has this... the ability to, like, cripple the world engine or something like that.
Yeah, send them to the Phantom Zone back there. I think
it does that, blah, blah. Why couldn't he just have thrown this thing into the world engine that's, crippling Metropolis? And why does he go all the way around to the other side of the world where there's no one to save for this realization? He could have just stayed in Metropolis and done the same thing. While this world engine is completely and utterly crippling Metropolis with, like, unbelievable, like, 9/11 corollaries, basically.
Yeah, there were. That was actually, that was kind of upsetting.
Like, it's so blatant.
Yeah, you're right. I agree.
And, you know, basically Ground Zero and, you know, within miles of this world engine thing, completely get flattened.
Yeah.
It's a complete, utter, gray wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, Superman doesn't stay around to, you know, cripple that world engine. He flies around the world where there's, you know, in the middle of the ocean
mm-hmm.
to make this epiphany that, yes, I'm finally going to save humanity and be that person.
I think he was trying to be that person the whole time. He just finally, like, found the strength to just fuck that world engine up.
Yes. And he also finds the strength to come back.
Yeah,
I don't know. What were you gonna say?
The whole thing was that the world engine and Metropolis had those shields around it, so they couldn't shoot the gravitational, whatever that shit was. But don't you think
someone who can, you know, leap tall buildings in a single bound could have like thrown it with super sonic this missile that could have crippled it?
Yeah, that's true.
Instead of sending, like, the military and Lois Lane into harm's way.
Yeah, you're right. I'm not going to argue that. You're right. Yeah.
So those are the logistical setbacks, which kind of completely make it unforgivable to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the one that really gets me is the fact that when he comes back and he has to fight Zod in the middle of already a complete, utter wasteland,
mm-hmm.
Which has, you know, unabashed 9/11,
right.
imagery.
Yeah.
He decides to fight him in the middle of this wasteland, and they just fly around, crashing through buildings, literally destroying buildings themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like, without any,
Classic Superman.
Superman is there to save humanity. All of the shit that Jonathan Kent was saying is that you are this god amongst humanity. You can choose to be against them. You can choose to be for them. He chooses to be for them, yet he does the same amount of destruction as the villains.
Yeah.
He just, you know, he throws Zod. He and Zod, like, battle through these buildings and just, like, he doesn't stop to make sure that there's, you know, people, you know, to save people in harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even, you know, a thought in his mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, you said before that, like, the
needs of the many.
The needs of the many, at least to Superman in the last fucking 45 minutes of this movie, the needs of the few outweigh the needs of the many to him. Especially in the end, where, for some reason, he corners Zod in this train station.
Yeah.
And Zod is about to, like, roast four fucking people, and he finally realizes that, no, he can't do this to people. Meanwhile, they've, like, completely flattened, like, countless city blocks of Metropolis fighting.
Right.
You know, and it takes, for some reason, it takes, like, four unnameless people to maybe be killed by Zod for him to realize this. And then after all of that wanton destruction, he just snaps Zod's neck, and that's right. it. Like, I was just like, this is fucking terrible. This movie, like, the last 45 minutes of this movie are, like, it's as if, you know, one person passed the screen, the script to someone else, and the other person didn't read what the other person wrote. You know,
yeah.
all of the things that he stands for, Superman at least,
right.
They're none of the actions, none of his actions in the last battles, you know, warrant that.
Right.
All of the stuff that Jonathan Kent, all of the stuff that Jor-El was talking about, saving humanity, being this god for them, and his choice to act for them is nonsense when you realize what he's done and the way he's acted and, you know, what he could have done, just snapped Zod's neck, and all of this stuff could have been, you know, it would have saved them,
mm-hmm.
you know, without all of this stuff
That's
happening.
True. But, okay.
Sorry.
No. I totally get where you're coming from. I really do. And, like, all right, here's my justification.
Yeah. Yes.
So, I think it all kind of boils down to that last scene in the train station for me. It's that, like, yeah, all it took was a snap of a neck, right? That's how easy it was for Superman to kill Zod, essentially. So, my thinking was that, you know, Superman, that whole effing fight with Zod, was already stronger than Zod. Like, he could have killed him, like, boom. No, just like that. Like, essentially. Like, if he had him in a headlock, if he got him in the right spot.
Mm.
So, my whole thing was that the whole movie is based around him trying to, like, find belonging, trying to find a home, and, like, how excited he was when he found, like, the Kryptonian spaceship and met his dad and all that jazz. And I feel like once he had Zod in the headlock, that was, like, the whole thing. And he's like, he's like, you can't do this. And Zod just says, like, I'll never stop trying to, like, enslave humanity or wipe out humanity. And that was, like, the moment where he's like, I was trying to get through, I was trying to have my cake and eat it too, says Superman mentally. I was trying to make it so that, like, me and the last, so I wouldn't be the last Kryptonian, so I wouldn't have to kill the last member of my own people, and I could save humanity in the process. But he sees those people that he's about to roast, like you said, and he's just like, you know what, it's like, his hand was forced. Like, that's what all the destruction was, I feel like. It's kind of my justification for it. That's what I was, like, hoping they were talking about, like, when the mics weren't catching it, like, stop doing this, like, like, look what you've done, like, these are good people. But, and then once he realizes that, like, he has to kill this guy, like, he'll never stop until every last person is wiped out, then he snaps his neck and he has that big cry moment. And he saves those people in the train station. But, I mean,
he surely didn't save the hundreds of thousands of people.
I know.
It just seems like that justification, I would have to argue that justification is completely false based on his actions.
I know.
I guess he could be like, well, collateral damage. I guess I'm not going to do that from now on. But it's just like, I think it's just not true.
Yeah.
And I would also argue that he decided to save humanity, you know, when he took the time to cook up this whole scheme with these world engine things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he's seen what it's doing.
Yeah.
You know, to Metropolis.
Right.
And he's seen how these people, at least these last Kryptonians, have treated his mother, his Earth mother, and what they've done to Smallville.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I don't know, were you going to say something else after that?
No, I mean, it's one of those things that I'm just kind of like, it's an ignorance is bliss kind of thing. I'm like, maybe those buildings were evacuated. Maybe everyone's
dead. Yeah.
But,
maybe I would be, you know, tempted to agree with you if it weren't for the story beats with, like, Perry White and Jenny Olsen or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, those are stand-ins for the complete destruction that's happening. You know, you can just imagine that, you know, hundreds of thousands of other people are going through the same things based on what's happening around them.
Yeah.
You know, and you can just, you can realize that those buildings weren't evacuated.
Yeah.
You know, it was a sort of, like, pretty offensive, you know, co-opting of 9/11 imagery.
Yeah, I'll give you
to, like,
that.
Implant into this, like, summer blockbuster.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know. I mean, I feel bad for just trying to... Like, I don't want you to feel bad about how you feel about this movie.
No, oh, stop. Get out of here. I'm just saying, apologize. Like, no, I mean, this is stuff that I was already thinking when I was watching the movie. Yeah. I was like, you know, when the building started falling and shit, I'm like, this is very atypical of Superman behavior. Yeah. Like, you know...
It is absolutely atypical.
Part of me is like, it's Kryptonian stuff. Like, it's just like, Zod is the one... It's like it takes two people like in a situation like this to make a building fall. But I don't know. It's like it's more. I feel like the reason I'm justifying these last 45 minutes more, the more we talk about it, is me trying to convince myself, being like, you know, like Superman had this whole other like thing going on, like emotionally, and that's why he let so much go down. And like, you know, the rest of humanity got saved, like. There's a cost to be paid in situations like this, unfortunately. Like, Superman can't save everybody. But but still, you know, yeah, it's hard to ignore, like, when the buildings are falling down, especially with, you know, the world.
Especially
like,
if the buildings are falling down because of Superman.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, by the same token, like, Superman's not, like, intentionally flying into buildings, not being like, fuck this building. Like, it knocking it down. I mean,
but he does use them to sort of try to slow Zod down.
Yeah, it's like a Kryptonian battle. It's like, you know, this stuff, like, I'm not surprised stuff like this happens, but it happens to such an extreme degree, like you said. Yeah. Just kind of like, okay.
Yeah. I feel like the Superman that I was promised in the beginning, who helped those guys in the oil rig, you know, by, like, holding up the entire oil rig itself.
Yeah.
You know, and the Superman that I got at the end were two different people.
Oh, that's a good point. I mean, and it was different. It was a different situation in Superman's defense.
Sure.
But, yeah.
It could have held up the buildings or something.
Yeah, that's true. But, I mean, you're totally right in the sense that it could have been... I mean, it didn't have to be written that way. Like, it could have been something else. They could have been fighting in space. They could have blown up the moon or something.
That's true as well.
Like, they could have done something. But, yeah, that was kind of...
And anyway...
Yeah, I know what you mean. And it's a really hard point to defend.
Yeah.
It's kind of
I should say that I went into this movie... I went into it being... It being the most anticipated movie of the summer for
me.
And I watched it, and it started off well, and I just kind of spent the next hour or two being, like, trying to resolve, like, what I just saw...
Yeah.
And I just couldn't, you know, agree with it. And I was just like,
this
is terrible.
No, I totally get it. And especially for, like, the reasons you have. It's, like, totally justified. And, I mean, you're not alone on that either. Like, you look at the reviews and it's just like...
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I got, like, 60-something comments on my review just telling me how, like, I don't have any soul.
Isn't it fun writing for publications?
It's great.
Like,
it was, like, the most... Yeah, the worst vitriol, like, thrown at me since The Hobbit.
Yeah, you gotta have a thick skin when you write for sites like that.
It was tough. It was people being, like, just saying the most absurd shit about how, like, opinions don't matter.
Yeah.
And you're like, what?
That's interesting. calling
for me to quit, or, like, saying I'm not a movie fan or something like that.
That's great. The things people invest their time and energy into never seems to amaze
me. That's how I gotta look at it. At least they read it. At least they clicked.
Yeah, well, there you go, man. Latino review. But
anyway.
Well, you know, I think I'm more swayed by your opinion than you are mine, but by the same token, it's just like, I don't know, I'm just such a sucker for Superman stories. And after seeing Superman 2 and being like, what the fuck is this? And just seeing that, and I was like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, that's the Superman that I was kind of hoping for.
Yeah.
Even though it gets totally skewed, like towards the end, it just gets very, very muddled is a kind way to put it, I feel like.
Yeah. I'll take Superman Returns.
Yeah, I really want to see Superman Returns again. I feel like that really is closer to what I really like about Superman as like a I don't know, fictional god of sorts. Mm-hmm. But anyway,
that's the Man of Steel showdown.
That was a good showdown, man. That was a long-ass showdown.
Yeah, I mean, well, do you want to do segment three or what?
Yeah, let's do segment three. Let's just run through it. All that right. was a good
Seems
one.
Like anticlimactic, but...
No, that was good. That was good. That was a good heart-to-heart. I dig it.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So, in honor of the Lone Ranger, we're all doing Best Western Ever. are you excited for the Lone Ranger, Sean?
You know, I like Gore Verbinski.
Really?
I think he's a dude who can do all these, like, massive... blockbuster movies and inject some heart into it.
Yeah.
And he can make them really weird, just like Pirates of the Caribbean was pretty weird.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Rango is really weird. I don't know
Rango.
How...
I liked it more than any of those Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Yeah. So maybe he can bring some sort of, you know, that unique weirdness to Lone Ranger. I heard it was good.
It's supposed to be weird. It's supposed to have a lot of supernatural stuff in it, so I hear.
The like production history is one of those.
That was
things
like,
where you hear about it before you actually see anything of the movie.
Yeah,
because it's apparently rewritten and the budget was slashed and everything. But
yeah, what are your thoughts on Johnny Depp as Tonto?
I mean,
he is part Cherokee. I'm
just kind of over Johnny Depp.
Yeah,
he doesn't act anymore. He's just doing
Keith Richards. Yeah,
it's just impressions. It's not acting anymore, and he's just, you know, he gets like $20 billion a movie or something.
Yeah, he's
like
doing all right for himself.
And you know, the other movies that he does are just shitty Tim Burton movies.
That's
it's not
true.
Like he's taking any. I mean, I guess that movie, The Rum Diary, was.
I heard that was not good.
Yeah, I heard that was not good either. That I guess was a continuation of his like Hunter Thompson thing, but he hasn't done a unique, or I shouldn't say unique, but he hasn't done like a. An interesting smaller profile movie in a while.
Yeah,
maybe he's out. That's out of his league.
Yeah,
or he's too big for that. But anyway.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Well, I hope it's good. I'll probably see it. Anyway, what's your best Western ever, Sean?
I have to say, my best Western ever comes from someone who basically has defined the Western in the American cinematic canon. Featuring an actor who's defined the Western in the American cinematic canon. And I don't think this choice is a cliche. It's Stagecoach.
I've never seen Stagecoach.
From John Ford starring... Actually, the first John Ford movie starring John Wayne.
Yeah,
young John
right.
Wayne.
I remember Quentin Tarantino not too long ago said that. He thinks that's like the ultimate hangout movie is what he calls it.
Oh,
yeah. Anyway,
it's
great.
It tells the story of... this stagecoach featuring a group of like this ragtag group of stagecoach people trying to get through, I guess, I forget what the Indians are, what tribe they are, Cherokee Country, Tonto.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, not Tonto.
That's a person, brother.
No, I know.
Squaw?
No, God damn it. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah.
But they're trying to get through their territory, the Indian territory.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on, let me look it up here. They're going through. They're trying to get through Geronimo.
Hey.
Geronimo's territory, Apaches.
Oh, there we go.
We're on
the
war path.
You know?
Yeah. And it features this ragtag group of people featuring like a prostitute, an alcoholic doctor, this pregnant woman. A whiskey salesman and this banker who are all trying to get to Lordsburg, which is through Apache territory.
Mm-hmm.
It basically John Wayne plays this outlaw who they find and who helps them get through it.
Oh, all right.
It's a pretty simple story. It has interesting, more weight in the, sociological kind of, connotations behind, the fact that, you know, the outlaw and the prostitute are basically the better, you know, the more wholesome people out of all these characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pregnant woman is you know, pretty bitchy, and she, like, she's pretty offensive. There's a former Confederate soldier that joins up with them and is you know, being her servant, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And he's obviously a Confederate soldier, and he's a gangster, or like a card salesman. He's kind of like a fop, you know.
Mm-hmm. Fop, we got to bring that one back.
Yeah, he's like a dandy. There you go. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's a simple story, as most of the best Westerns are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, you know, the details and the scenery that Ford implants in them are really awesome and really noteworthy. And I think, you know, it's the prototypical John Wayne performance. He plays the Ringo Kid.
Oh, that's a good name.
Who's an outlaw who joins up with them because he needs to get to Lordsburg because the outlaws who killed his brother are there.
Oh, man.
And so he takes this kind of you know, suicide mission through Apache country just so he can get the prospect of, like, getting revenge on his brother's killers. Which plays out in the end as well.
Oh, that's cool. Is it a long movie? Am I mistaken?
No, it's actually 96 minutes.
Oh, I'm thinking Rio Bravo then. I think that's a long
one. It's pretty efficient.
Oh,
and
nice.
It's, you know, like I said, the photography is amazing. It's in the, like, Ford, Ford's Monument Valley,
mm-hmm.
you know, with all the really wide open countryside.
Yeah.
Not as complex as The Searchers.
Right. Yeah.
But it has a place in my heart as you know, one of my favorite, just like really action packed, yet really dramatically heavy. You know, and I don't say heavy as like a detrimental thing. It's like really dramatically complex, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But not as much as The Searchers, like I just said.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I was thinking you were gonna say The Searchers.
I mean, The
Searchers
is great.
We've talked about that before, and that's like, isn't that something you and your dad used to watch or something? Or am I
no.
making that up?
No. I had seen it.
I
went to see
it
on,
in theater.
Yeah, I went to see it on the big screen.
Yeah.
But Stagecoach is one of those ones that it's just a really simple Western from 1939 that I think opened the door for a lot of the other, you know, Westerns that define the genre. But, you know, the one that started it all, to me, is the best.
I think that's, yeah. I mean, that was, like, the one that started it all, really. That's, like, the seminal old-timey John Ford Western, yeah. I gotta see that, man. I really gotta do my homework.
I mean, it's on Hulu Plus, I think.
Oh, I think I can. I can borrow my friend's account for that.
Let me just look it up. Hold on, and I'll just make sure. Because otherwise, I mean, it's out on the Criterion Collection.
Oh right, so they've got.
It's totally worth it.
Yeah.
They put it out on this edition that has a ton of stuff, including a complete other movie by John Ford, The Silent Western, as just like a supplement on the disc. Interviews with Ford, interviews with other, you know, Western film historians. It is on Hulu. So
sweet.
You should watch it.
Right,
I should also say that it features one of the greatest action scenes I've ever seen.
Whoa.
This is a movie from the 1930s.
Damn.
You know? You know, and considering it's all on screen, and it was all done, this particular scene of this, like, when they finally meet up with the Apaches, and they like, make a break across this wide open plain, you know, this Apache attack is done by this, the stunts were done by this guy, let me look it up. Oh, this guy named Yakima Canut.
That's a good name, too, man.
Yeah, who stands in for John Wayne in all his, like, jumping from horse to horse
doing
all this stuff. And it's genuinely thrilling, and it's from the 30s, and I was just like, wow, this is, like, you know, pretty notable considering how old it is and
wild,
you know, all it represents. So I would definitely steal your friend's Hulu Plus thing.
No, I'm totally going to steal
my
friend's.
I mean, if you want, you can steal mine and watch it.
Hey, no.
I feel the need that you should watch it, especially as someone is...
Yeah,
a big fan
of
Westerns like you and I.
Yeah, I'll get on that. Absolutely. Yeah. I can't believe I actually haven't seen that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad you liked it so much.
Yeah.
All right. So, as for my best Western, I think we've already established that High Noon is my favorite movie of all time. But I'm not going to talk about that because I've already talked about it in the first episode. Y'all should listen if you haven't listened to it. And I feel like the other two go-tos are Once Upon a Time in the West, which I would usually go to if I hadn't seen it in high school. It was like the last time I saw it. The other one is Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, obviously, which is great, you know, for all the obvious reasons. But I don't know. I felt like going for something different this time. I felt like whereas you went with the original one, I'm going with the best Western that I've seen in, like, recent memory. Because Westerns are, like, hard to come by these days. Like, of the two good Westerns that I've seen maybe the last decade, one was, what was it? 310 to Yuma. I thought that was really good. I was surprised how good that was, the remake. But the one I'm going with is The Proposition. Did you ever see that?
That's another one that I like watched a really long time ago.
Yeah.
Like at the beginning of college, and I just kind of forgotten about
it. That's also when I saw it. I saw it like junior year, I remember, or something like that. And
yeah,
I remember when it came out and I missed it, and I was really bummed because I really liked the idea of like an Australian Western. But I remember there were a few movies I can count on my hand where I remember watching, like, putting it in at the middle of the night, just being like, I'm going to fall asleep to this movie. And then just being, like, sitting upright till 2 in the morning, being like, holy shit, like, this movie's unbelievable. And that was one of those movies. And it's just, I've recommended it to, like, anyone and everyone, and everyone except Sully, our friend, everybody, was like, I fell asleep during that movie. It was boring as hell. And Sully was like, that movie's incredible. That was one of the best recommendations ever. And I just, like, loved it. It's just, it's a slow burn, totally, and like a Western should be. And it just, with all these Australian, it's like so much of it is filmed at, like, the golden hour. And it's just like these big sky country Australian landscapes where like no one showers and there's like everyone's bloody and it's just bad people doing bad shit. And like the whole premise is like these two brothers, one of them gets arrested and is at risk of being hanged, if I remember correctly. But the sheriff of this town gives him a proposition, hence the title. That says, if you bring your brother to me, who's like the way worse brother, who's like a real bastard, then I'll let you go and I'll hang him instead. And so the brother, the good quote unquote brother, goes to get him and bring him.
It was Guy Pearce, right?
That's Guy Pearce, yeah. And the bad brother, I forget. Hold on, I got IMDb.
Danny Houston?
Yeah, Danny Houston. Yeah, is that him? Yeah. Anyway. So, he brings...
Danny Houston.
Yeah, and so, that's kind of the story. It's like, it's totally like, I don't know, Cain and Abel kind of story. And
yeah. It's interesting that you chose, like, an Australian Western.
I think that's, like, really one of the appeals to it. Like, this is, like, totally... It's such, like, an American, you know, like, it's seminally American genre. Like, no other countries, well, except Italy, I guess, make Westerns, but even those take place in America. It was just, I don't know, I was really taken aback by it, and it's so gritty, it's so in your face, and it's just so, like, uncompromisingly a Western. Not, like, people don't look like Guy Pearce is a good-looking guy, and, like, these people are just, like...
so much grit.
Yeah, it's just, like, you could taste the dirt, man, when you're watching this movie.
And John Hillcoat, the director.
Yeah, and he did The Road, which I really liked too.
Yes. Did you see Lawless as well?
I didn't hear great things. I heard
about Lawless?
Yeah, I heard mixed things. Did you see it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a pretty underrated movie.
Oh, that's
good. I think people are pissed off about Shia LaBeouf in that movie.
Everybody's
pissed off about Shia. But yeah, The Road, I think, is another gritty movie. Yeah. I think he's a dude who knows his grit.
Yeah, he does. And the other thing that was cool about it is, you know, Nick Cave and the Seeds, that band?
Yeah.
Like, Nick Cave
wrote it.
Yeah, he wrote it, and he scored the whole thing, which is, like, that's, like, the most fucking badass selling point to, like, any movie, let alone an Australian Western that's, like, as gritty as could be. So it was just kind of, like, a lot of elements coming together that I was like, man, this is just, like, if more movies like this, please. More, like, if we had more Westerns in the world, this world would be a much better place to live in. But
I think that's why it's I mean, Australian Westerns are interesting is because the American mythology is kind of wiped out.
Right.
And it's up to, you know, the Italians, I guess, to appropriate it for themselves.
Yeah.
To the Australians to appropriate it for themselves. Up to, and I think even you can make the case, I mean, you know, the Japanese, you know, the samurai, some of those Kurosawa samurai movies are ostensibly, you know, the guy, the samurai with no name, the guy with no name just walking into town.
It's
like a, you know, so it's, you know, the Japanese appropriating the Western into this, into their culture.
Those grifters.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting that we both chose these films at the kind of polar opposite of the genre.
Yeah, that is actually interesting. I didn't think of that.
The one that started it all and the one that I guess is ostensibly the best recent one, which is far away from that, as you know, as far away from the original one that I chose that you can get.
Yeah, and I mean, if I hadn't talked about it, like, I would have picked High Noon, and that's, like, one of, it's just, like, seminal American, like, right there, like, front to back, but I don't know, I feel like, for the proposition is, like, there aren't too many movies that I just really like to recommend to people, like, within a given year, and that was one that I was just like, holy shit, like, you guys have gotta see this, like, it just knocked me on my ass how good it was, and, I mean, I feel like that's one of these movies that just really hasn't gained traction over the years, unfortunately. But I don't think most Westerns these days gain traction like that, as good as they are.
Yeah, for some reason.
Which is too bad. It's like, I don't know, attention spans, I suppose.
Yeah, which I think, I don't know, it's a big gamble with The Lone Ranger, which is like this $200 million movie.
Yeah, well, luckily they threw Johnny Depp in there as a Native American and threw some supernatural shit in there to mix it up.
Yeah, I guess they're,
But, I mean, yeah, I feel like part of me is just kind of putting this in this segment because I just wish more people would go see The Proposition, even if it's gonna, even if they're gonna fall asleep to it, like just the occasional Sully who loves it is just like, holy shit.
It used to be on Netflix, but it's not there anymore.
That's,
I don't know,
too bad.
Yeah, I feel like it's one of those movies that will benefit from being widely available like that.
I mean, hopefully one day with, like, if John Hillco really gets like a big break and just like, you know, not like The Road. I don't know. People didn't really like flock to The Road either, which shocked me.
Yeah, that's such a depressing
movie.
It's like one of the most,
like,
depressing movies I've ever seen.
That was a big book too when it came out, I thought.
True.
So I don't know, but
he's one of those guys. He's one of those guys that I think could break out, and if that happens, it, you know, the latter could lead back to
I hope so. Because I feel I was thinking Chris Nolan, but like Chris Nolan broke out with Memento, like. It's just been uphill from her in there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, whatever. Those are two solid Westerns. It's such a great genre. I love Westerns so much, so.
I mean, the Western is ostensibly what, you know, is American mythology. That's what, you know, what America is going to be known for in terms of storytelling.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and then the themes, I guess, are, you know, broad enough, you know, to last that long.
Yeah.
So.
Man. Superman and the Westerns. This is like the most goddamn American episode we've had.
America. Yeah. So.
I know. Anyway, good pick, Sean.
Yeah. Ooh, we go. Ooh. This is like an hour and.
Yeah, this is running long. Yeah.
Running long, that's right. Only our moms will listen
to
it.
That was a mean showdown. Hell no. We got 17 hits the other day. We are like, we are like, it's popular as shit.
Right. I haven't even asked about the numbers or anything.
Oh,
but anyway.
All
right. Yeah, it was a good episode, good showdown, and good choices.
Hell yeah, that was heated. That was good.
Where can everyone find your thang on the internet?
Oh, I'm on the Twitters. I'm at CTCMRDOTCOM. That's CTCMR.com. And that's also the URL of my website. So, at Cut the Crap Movie Reviews. That's where you can find my stuff. How about you, Sean?
You can find my reviews at latinoreview.com. I'm doing news stuff, Criterion-related, at criterioncast.com. I'm also doing some freelance writing about all kinds of different topics at mentalfloss.com. I've got some stuff coming up for Canada Day on July 1st.
That's a thing?
Coming out, yeah. I got three things. You should check them out.
Okay,
and on Twitter, I say my Twitter name at the end of all the podcasts that I'm on, and I get no new followers.
What?
But
I
either
don't
way,
either, man, but you gotta say it.
It's twitter.com/Sean. Two S's, three E's, three A's, and two N's.
Nice. That was good. All right. Well, what are you going to see this weekend? Anything big?
Not really.
You already saw this stuff. You got White House Down. What else
is going on? I'm trying to go see Pacific Rim sometime soon, which, you know, was my second most anticipated one, but hopefully that doesn't...
I'm hoping that doesn't suck, man. The anime nerd inside me is like, all right, this is going to be the bomb, but, like...
I don't even really care about anime. I just think it looks as a good summer blockbuster, and Guillermo del Toro...
I know, that helps. Always helps. It's
pretty cool, too, so... Yeah. Anything on your radar?
I got to see Before Midnight, and maybe I'll squeeze World War Z, but I'm not, like, itching and chomping at the bit to see that, so...
Before Midnight, do it.
Yeah. I'm totally... That comes first.
All right. Well, until next time.
Yeah, everybody. Sean,
catch you later.
Yeah. All right. See you later, everybody. Keep it real. Bye.